You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Oscar Guardiola-Rivera from Birkbeck University. Very good morning to you, Oscar. What have you got in store for us?
Is money the root of all evil? Pope Francis seems to think so. VP, on the other hand, needs its money.
Thanks very much, Oscar. Also ahead, we'll head to the Sahara to hear about the so-called forgotten conflict of North Africa.
Dark, dreary grey, that's typically our picture of 1920s London, but are we finally starting to see things in a different light?
Your immediate reaction to it is, oh, wow, isn't that lovely? And then the second thing that will happen is you'll look at the date and you go, oh, no, that's wrong. That's just wrong. It can't possibly be that long ago.
And for Europe's kings and queens of pop, not to mention Fernando Augusto Pacheco of this parish, their day of reckoning is almost upon us as Malmo prepares to host the Eurovision Song Contest final.
All that plus we play some music too, not necessarily Eurovision-esque, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But before all that, let's get the latest world news now from Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Nigeria's army has begun operations against militant Islamists in the northeast of the country. Military officials say troops have raided parts of a game reserve in Borno State, where the Boko Haram group has established bases. The raids came after a state of emergency was declared in Borno, Yobe and Adamawa estates. 2,000 people have died there since Boko Haram launched an insurgency in 2009. A dusk-to-dawn curfew has been imposed in Adamawa to curb militant attacks. President Barack Obama says the US has seen evidence of chemical weapons being used in Syria. However, speaking after meeting Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he insisted it was important to discover more specific details about alleged chemical attacks. Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper has expressed his concern about the Syrian crisis. He's told delegates at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York stronger support is needed for the West's ally in the area, Israel. And he's urged President Obama to act with caution over Syria.
This is a terrible regime. Canada has some of the toughest sanctions in the world against the Assad regime. We believe, as everybody believes, that he should step down and there should be a transition. But we should not fool ourselves about what is happening in Syria. To just start talking about, you know, as some do, arming unnamed people whose objectives, whose identities we don't know and whose objectives we do not understand, I think is extremely risky.
New York officials say they've broken up a multi-million dollar cigarette smuggling ring. They're claiming three of the 16 Palestinian immigrants they've charged have links with known terrorists. New York State's Attorney General says investigators have recovered only a fraction of the proceeds from sales of more than a million untaxed cartons. Records show the suspects deposited at least $55 million. A lorry driver is in a critical condition after falling 20 metres when his vehicle crashed and almost fell off a busy freeway in Melbourne. The driver, who's in his 30s, had swerved to avoid a car that veered in front of him. His lorry rolled and hit the side of the busy road, throwing him onto the road below. The lorry is still dangling off the freeway, but it's been secured until cranes are brought in to remove it. This witness, Joe, says he's surprised the driver's still alive.
There was no signs of obvious trauma, no blood or anything like that, no bones protruding or anything like that. So I was amazed. I saw the truck as well hanging upside down and I couldn't believe he was still conscious.
Investigations into a deadly blast at a Texas fertilizer plant have failed to find a cause. Officials say there are three possible causes of the fire: a malfunction in the plant's 120-volt electrical system, a golf cart that may have given off a spark, or it may have been started intentionally. The April the 17th blast killed 15 people, injured 200 and flattened part of the town of West. The explosion was so powerful, debris from it was found up to 2.5 miles away. A quarter of gay people surveyed in an extensive EU poll say they've been subjected to attacks or violent threats in the past 5 years. The survey found poorer and younger respondents were more likely to face discrimination over their sexuality. the EU's Fundamental Rights Agency surveyed 93,000 people in the EU and Croatia. Friday marks the International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. The time is 5 minutes past the hour and you're with Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
We start today's show with our agenda setter. I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by Oscar Guardiola Rivera, author and senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University, who brings us the stories we need to know for the following 24 hours. Welcome to the show, Oscar. What do we need to know?
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Well, today the theme is the love of money the root of all evil? Pope Francis seems to think so. He called on world leaders to end the cult of money and to do more for the poor. In his first major speech on the financial crisis, he said that free market economics had created a tyranny in which people were valued only by their ability to consume.
Is this going to make any difference whatsoever that he's saying all of these things, which is not exactly breaking news for many parts of the world?
At the very least, it should do it should make a difference within the Vatican City. One of the interesting facts here is that he announced that for the first time, the Vatican's own bank, the Institute for Works of Religion, is going to publish its annual report. For the first time in history, this is one of the most secretive banks in the world. It has been at the center of several financial scandals, not the least money laundering.
This was a recent scandal as well. Are you terribly surprised about a man who took the name Francis, as Saint Francis, the patron saint of the poor. Are you surprised that this is what his first agenda was? This was top of his agenda?
Not at all. In fact, that's what everybody expected. Having said that, it is really interesting to notice that this is really the core of Christian belief, the very old idea expressed by Saint Paul before, that the love of money is the root of all evil. And it is very topical. We are not only in the middle of a financial crisis, but it is becoming clearer and clearer that the origin of the crisis has to do with our obsession with profit.
But I want to know what difference it will make that he's saying this, because, as you say, this is gripping, this is a very topical issue, but 'twas ever thus, in a way. And do you think he is going to wield the power? Do you think he has the authority to actually enact a complete reset or a rethink of the agenda?
At the very least, he's going to try to do so to the extent that the Catholic Church still has influence in parts of the world, particularly in Latin America, in Africa and elsewhere. Having said that, there is also a growing concern in non-Catholic Christian countries about the idolization of money. And since this is really a subjective issue, something that will not be changed by structural reform on its own, it is important that he points it out.
Do you think perhaps if you just have a single voice, such as the Pope, saying the rich should pay more attention to the poor, people will be very ready to dismiss it? But if you start getting a collective voice, I'm thinking perhaps about the British Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, an economist himself. If you get a combination of voices from the church, whichever section of the church you choose to go with, do you think that could perhaps make a difference? Or are we still just tilting at windmills?
I think it could make a difference. Of course, this is not something that is going to change from one day to the next. But it is the case that religion is still a force in the world, and this can prove that it can still be a force for good.
One of the things that fascinated me was that Pope Francis says that the world is struggling under this dictatorship, under the tyranny of money, and it's an economy which lacks any real human goal. And you think for a pope to be talking about human goals as opposed to spiritual goals, for example, is a really interesting state of where we are.
Also, an important difference, if you compare this pope with the previous ones, for this pope it's absolutely clear that spiritual goals are human goals. And it is about protecting the weak rather than just thinking about what's coming next.
And the fact that he is obviously from Argentina and this call is coming from a South American pope, how do you think this comment will now resonate in on the continent?
It will be very welcome, among other things, because the struggle for poverty has been at the core of all political and legal reforms in the last decade and a half in Latin America. And things seem to be working in a different way over there than here. So in a way, this is perhaps the beginning of a model being exported elsewhere.
Thinking about protecting the weak and the poor, BP's financial recovery. I'm not classing BP as weak and poor, I hasten to add, but they are suffering because of having to pay out to those who suffered during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010. Tell us more about this story.
Well, this story is precisely an example of what happens when money rules, on both sides. BP is complaining that the interpretation of rules for assessing business economic loss are being systematically abused. Colossal sums are being handed to enterprises that suffer no detriment from the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. So you have both sides. On the one hand, BP, which wreaked havoc in the Gulf and is going to have to pay for it. On the other hand, those affected, among them people who may have not been accepted, but are filing complaints in court in order to get some money.
What's enabling these people to file compensation claims? Is it the fact that they're not, the detriment doesn't necessarily have to be entirely financial?
Yes. Under the agreement for compensation that was that came out of U.S. courts last year, you have to prove loss of income. And of course, when it comes down to how you prove loss of income, it seems that some people may only be, have to prove that from 1 month to the next one, during the time of the disaster, their income fell, even if there is no, strictly speaking, direct causation. And BP is saying that that is becoming so threatening that it might actually destroy the financial viability of the company.
BP not likely to have a chorus of sympathetic voices, do you think?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. But it seems to be increasingly worried about this. It has asked David Cameron to raise the issue at the next GH meeting of the government of the world's richest country, which the UK is hosting next month. And is also saying that it will be irreparably harmed unless the compensation system is reformed
fast.
What
kind of legal precedent could this now set?
It will be a very interesting legal precedent because so far, legal responsibility of MNCs, multinational corporations, has been dealt at a pretty, vague level of abstraction, kind of ethical guidelines, the UN Global Compact, that sort of thing. This would be one of the first cases in which a company is really made to suffer financially for, being responsible for a disaster such as this one.
Tell us about toilet paper in Venezuela, finally. Well, can't resist this story.
We've been waiting all day.
It's incredibly funny. I mean, from whatever side you see this story, is just incredibly funny. I mean, what is the price of a roll of toilet paper? Well, gold, if you're in Venezuela, apparently. The government blames political opponents for the shortfall.
Of course it does.
Toilet paper, of course. As it does for
Enrique
other shortages.
Enrique Capriles has been driving around with vans, just stealing people's toilet paper. This sounds entirely implausible, Oscar. Help us out.
Absolutely. But there is one point to rescue. Economists obviously say that, whenever you have state-controlled prices, whenever you set the price below market clearing, always you have shortages. But that means that this is, a decision. I mean, the point is that those who will sell toilet paper are not doing so because the price is just not good enough. What we see here is the old conundrum, whether profit should be the only incentive or there are other incentives. So far, the government has said that it's going to buy 50 million rolls of toilet paper and flood the market with toilet paper.
I love that this is also, this is being called a revolution. Yeah, the revolution will bring the country the equivalent of 50 million rolls of toilet paper. It does sound like a parody of itself.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the point when tragedies threaten to become farce. Let's hope that the Bolivarian Revolution does not go down in history as promising 50 million rolls of toilet paper.
Felled by double ply. How terrible. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you very much indeed for bringing us up to speed and setting the agenda in all manner of subjects.
Coming up, we'll be speaking to a journalist who's just returned from Western Sahara, something she's calling Africa's forgotten conflict.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the US and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
A fair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Welcome back to Midori House. 17 minutes past the hour. It's one of the toughest places on earth for journalists to get into. It's also the world's most populous non-self-governing territory, and it's been at war for nearly four decades. And yet we know scandalously little about the conflict that's been raging in Western Sahara since 1975 between Morocco and the Algeria-backed Polisario Front.
While the world focused hard on Mali last year, there's a growing number of calls for attention to be paid to the Western Sahara, and especially the Sahrawi, a group who are defined more by their geographical location rather than their ethnicity. Occupying desert that's governed by at least four countries, the Sahrawi claim they're being persecuted. Portia Walker is one of the few journalists to have managed to get to the region. She joins us now in the studio. A very warm welcome to the studio, Portia. When doing a tiny little bit of reading up on this story before we came on air, Clemency and I were astonished by how much little we knew, but also how much little is generally known about this place, the people who live there, and the conflict that's been plaguing it.
Well, absolutely. I was lucky enough to be able to go there. I returned last week. I went on a trip organised by the International Women's Media Foundation. But I understand we were the second group they've taken in. That we may be one of the second group of journalists to be actually allowed in by the government. And for years, in the week since I left, I think there was a Norwegian group and an Italian group who had gone in illegally and were forced out. So it's an incredibly hard place to get access to.
Portia, for those of us who aren't up to speed with the conflict, tell us more about the context of what's been going on there.
Well, okay, the area of Western Sahara, it's the sort of, if you look down, it zigzags out of Morocco to its southwest on the Atlantic coast, and it's about the size of England and Wales put together. It's desert, it's sparsely inhabited. There's around, I think, about 300,000 people. They're called the Sahrawis, and they're the native people. They're nomadic tribes. And in 1884, Spain took charge of the territory as colonizers. Now, they pulled out in 1975. By then, the Sahrawis had been agitating for independence for a couple of years. But, and as Spain pulled out, they thought, you know, here's our opportunity. Now we can start a self-determining state. However, I think before Spain had even left, the Moroccan king, who at the time was Hassan II, organised something called the Green March, where 300,000 Moroccans just marched south across the border and took over. And despite the efforts of the Sahrawi people, the UN, to hold a referendum, they've been there ever since.
And as a result, we have an area which is controlled by what we have. Morocco has a bit, Mauritania has a bit, the Western Sahara, which is this amorphous region that everybody's claiming to, and we also have a bit of south, and the Algeria wants to have a claim as well. What is the situation like there in terms of the fact that everybody is disputing this territory?
Well, yes, exactly. Everybody stakes a claim, and things become somewhat murky, because on the one hand you've got the independent struggle of the people who've always wanted self-determination. On the other, you get the sense that these people are being used to fight proxy wars between Morocco and Algeria, who have historically bad relations.
But is this a war about territory or about resources?
It's about self-determination for the Sahrawi people, but you're absolutely right to say resources, because Western Sahara is an area that's rich in phosphates and also in fishing. There's people also suspect there may be very good offshore, there may be offshore oil available just off the coast. So that's something the Sahrawi people feel very strongly, that they have these resources and they're not seeing the benefits of them.
We saw an awful lot of focus being paid to Mali last year. Why do you think that the rest of the world has paid so little attention to this area? I mean, as you say, there are vital resources there, and that generally sort of gets people to, you know, pay attention.
This is a terrible thing to say, and I'm sad to have to admit it, but for a long time this was an arms struggle in the sense of a guerrilla war by a group called the Polisario Front, who some of your listeners might remember, who are the body that represent the Sahrawi people and want an independent republic there. Now, they came to a ceasefire with the Moroccan forces in 1991. Since then, it's been a peaceful struggle. And I met a number of the activists while I was there, and they're very committed to peaceful struggle. There are demonstrations, and they turn into stone throwing, and, you know, there are scuffles, and, you know, there are injuries, but, you know, this is not an armed conflict. And as a result, you know, it doesn't grab the world's attention in the way other conflicts in the region do.
Because we're not seeing that level of bloodshed or... tell us quickly, I'm fascinated by the fact that many of the leaders and the activists there are female. This was not at all what I was expecting to hear.
It was not at all what I was expecting to see when I got there. I arrived and there was, while I was there, they had the largest protest they've had in decades, which, I mean, was, you know, comparatively for the standards of some of the protests we see in this part of the world, relatively small. It was, I saw about 1,000 people. There could have been more there. But what was striking was there were women there, and they wear these fantastic, multicoloured, sort of patterned, I suppose, robes is the word for them. And they were some of, you know, they're some of, I think, the bravest activists I met. Met two particularly impressive women, one of whom is Aminatou Haider, who's called the Gandhi of the Sahrawi people. And, you know, she's dealt with imprisonment, beatings. I met another woman who was covered in bruises. But there's no sense of them being pushed to the side and told, no, you're women, you're not going to go to this demonstration. They were very much, you know, at the forefront. And while we did interviews, I was quite struck by the deference shown to them by the male activists they worked alongside.
Portia, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. That was Portia Walker, who's just returned from a reporting fellowship with the International Women's Media Foundation in Western Sahara. You're listening to Midori House.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, 2 Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London,
this is Londres.
Or London.
London, Europa,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
Now, almost 90 years ago, the pioneering British cinematographer Claude Fries Greene captured London on film. His footage would become some of the highest quality colour pictures of the British capital ever created.
But the footage was never broadcast and remained largely forgotten until 2006, when the British Film Institute restored and published it. But it's only just now, thanks to a handful of internet users who stumbled across it online, that it's really gained widespread attention.
So why has this footage suddenly kindled the imagination of so many around the world, and what does its success online mean for other hidden gems from our cinematic past? Monocle's Thomas Lewis spoke to Bryony Dixon, a curator of silent film at the British Film Institute in London.
There is something about colour which brings stuff to life in a way that doesn't happen looking at black and white footage. And I think it's just startling when you see it. So your immediate reaction to it is, oh wow, isn't that lovely? And then the second thing that will happen is you'll look at the date and you go, oh no, that's wrong. That's just wrong. It can't possibly be that long ago. And it looks sort of new and modern and contemporary. It looks like it was shot in the 50s or 70s. The footage itself, which was made over 1925-1926, called The Open Road, was a travelogue which goes all the way from Land's End to John O'Groats, taking in London as its final stop. And it was made by Claude Fries Greene, and the intention was to demonstrate the qualities of his new natural colour system. This would enable him to show the beauties of the British landscape and people, and it had lots of beautiful things like, you know, little red-headed children. So it really made the best of that quality of colour, which in itself has that sort of effect of making things feel more modern and more real and more close to us rather than the kind of monochrome image. And he took the typical kind of tourist views, bridges, buses, traffic, bustling stuff, you know, there's the London Bobby directing the traffic. So it's a conventional view, but still very evocative. They were never released in the cinemas.
And maybe like the film itself back in the 1920s, your restoration of the film lay silent for a couple of years too. Why is there suddenly this spark of interest? How did that come about, and how is this footage now circulating so widely around the internet, among other things?
It's a remarkable feature of the internet that somebody just picking up on something one day and going, wow, isn't that fascinating, will get so much more traffic than something which is sort of based in on the TV or in cinema or whatever. It's nice, actually, because it's got that sort of feeling of somebody having made a personal discovery and just wanting desperately to communicate that to people. It's charming.
And what do you think it is about seeing these pictures in colour, seeing the textures of people's clothes, seeing the shades in colour in the buildings and the Houses of Parliament, for example? What do you think that does for maybe Londoners' perception of their own city? Does it sort of harden the link with one chapter of the past, do you think? Is that maybe why people have become so enthusiastic about this footage now?
It's familiar, and yet it's not quite familiar. What you see is people going to work, you see the traffic in the streets, you know, things are very kind of familiar. That about life in the city is experienced by all of us now. You know, you can still walk over Tower Bridge as it appears in the film. It looks exactly the same. And then there are sort of those surprising things. Women, for example, you know, they go to work. You know, they work in shops and stuff. It's not like they're all stuck at home, you know. So there is something about the 20s, I think, particularly. It was really the birth of that kind of modern city life. It's a very strange sensation. is kind of eerie and slightly unsettling. You associate the past so much with that monochrome look or the sepia tone of photographs. So there's something about seeing it in those terms makes it seem more modern. Therefore, you have a different attitude to it.
And why do you think that so many people, that it's caught on with so many people and caught so many people's imaginations now particularly?
I think because there is a huge resurgence in interest in London and London history. Obviously, last year it was very heavily focus of everybody's attention worldwide. And it's something to do with the fact that it's in colour.
It feels like the filmmaker was doing this out of a sense of affection for the city and for the UK. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yes, there's definitely an affection for the city and the familiar landmarks, and it's in a long tradition, in fact, of travelogues about London.
And these films came maybe 40 years, I think, before the BBC, for example, started broadcasting in colour. How groundbreaking was this series of films and the technologies that Claude Frees Green pioneered?
Well, it was the colour technique used in The Open Road was, in fact, a dead end because it never really went into production. It was the one in a long line of colour systems that were being experimented with by British filmmakers and filmmakers all over the world. There was a race to get the first natural colour technique nailed down and in commercial production. And whoever won that race was going to make a lot of money. It's important because it's almost unique to have a really good set of images all around the UK and London in colour and really beautifully shot, you know. Claude Frees Green really knew what he was doing when he was taking those views. And, you know, the more people get to see it, the better. And particularly Londoners, I mean, what a treat for them.
British Film Institute's Bryony Dixon talking to Thomas Lewis there with a little help from someone playing the piano.
Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be continuing our week-long series on that sweetest of guilty pleasures, the Eurovision Song Contest, and we will head to Turkey for a taste of that country's culinary past.
But first, with the time at 32 minutes past the hour, a little late, here's Bill with the headlines.
Nigeria's army has begun operations against militant Islamists in the northeast of the country. Military officials say troops have raided parts of a game reserve in Borno State, where the Boko Haram group has established bases. The raids came after a state of emergency was declared in Borno, Yobe and Adamawa states. 2,000 people have died there since Boko Haram launched an insurgency in 2009. President Barack Obama says the US has seen evidence of chemical weapons being used in Syria. However, speaking after meeting Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he insisted it was important to discover more specific details about alleged chemical attacks. New York officials say they've broken up a multi-million dollar cigarette smuggling ring. They're claiming three of the 16 Palestinian immigrants they've charged have links with known terrorists. A lorry driver is in a critical condition after falling 20 metres when his vehicle crashed and almost fell off a busy freeway in Melbourne. The driver, who's in his 30s, had swerved to avoid a car that veered in front of him. His lorry rolled and hit the side of the busy road, throwing him onto the road below. Investigations into a deadly blast at a Texas fertilizer plant have failed to find a cause. Officials say there are three possible causes of the fire: a malfunction in the plant's 120-volt electrical system, a golf cart that may have given off a spark, or it may have been started deliberately. A quarter of gay people surveyed in an extensive EU poll say they've been subjected to attacks or violent threats in the past 5 years. The survey, coinciding with the International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia, found poorer and younger respondents were more likely to face discrimination over their sexuality. Those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
The 34 minutes past eight here in London. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Emma Nelson. Now, Turkish food has a long and rich tradition, and as Istanbul's international profile continues to grow, there's a renewed interest in Turkey's rich culinary history unfolding in the city.
And as a result, chefs are looking to the corners of Turkey to uncover food treasures. For this week's episode of The Menu, Monocle's Joseph Dana visits one restaurant in Istanbul that's embracing Turkey's food history to find out how the city's rapid growth is spurring on a food renaissance.
This is zahtar salad. Zahtar is kind of wild thyme. It's not oregano, it's not thyme, it's kind of in the middle. Some sources say it's lemon thyme, but it's definitely something interesting, Mediterranean.
I'm sitting with the Kurdish chef Delal Tsivan at Chia, a restaurant in Istanbul's Kadıköy neighborhood. The restaurant is packed with tourists, mesmerized by the beautiful assortment of dishes, prepared in an open, family-style kitchen. Upstairs, Turkish families are quietly savoring long-forgotten recipes and marveling at the excited interest of the foreigners. Before us is a seemingly unending spread of Turkish food, reflecting Turkey's impossible perch as a bridge between three continents.
This yellow one is fava beans with saffron, and these three are from the stuffed group, stuffed dried eggplant, stuffed dried pepper, and the stuffed grape leaves.
Yep. Okay, so let's try it.
Okay, go ahead.
Not by myself, though.
Turkey's changing food culture is a lot like its growing international presence. For the past 15 years, people from around the country have flooded into Istanbul, eager for opportunity and quick to forget their culinary heritage. In a country where most people regard their mother as the world's best chef, the influx of Turks to Istanbul has presented an opportunity to centralize the country's diverse food trends. Andrew Finkel is a journalist who has lived in Istanbul for the past 20 years and writes regularly about the food scene in Turkey.
Think about this transition that Turkey's trying to make in the kitchen is that it's a transition from sort of craft to art, as it were. It used to be the case that it was pretty difficult to get a bad meal in Turkey. Maybe it was difficult, impossible to get a really great one, but the level of food was really very good, and of course that's one of the attractions being here. But you know, people wouldn't go to a restaurant in order to get something new and original and something they couldn't possibly eat anywhere else. They would go to get something that was cooked that little bit better, that something familiar that they understood, which was just done incredibly well. And of course, I've had friends whose mothers go out to eat not because they want the food to be good, but to prove to themselves that the food they make is better better than the food they would find in a restaurant.
Chia is the brainchild of Musa Degdivarin. Open in the heart of Kadıköy's fish market more than 26 years ago, the restaurant has been described as a laboratory of Anatolian cuisine, an ethnographic museum, and the garden of lost cultures and forgotten tastes. Since 2005, he and his wife have been publishing a quarterly magazine, Yemin ve Kultur, Food and Culture. Chia's popularity and unique approach to Turkish food has sparked a flurry of media attention, and on any given day, queues stretching beyond the door aren't uncommon. Zeynep Jalaska is Degdivarin's wife and co-owner. They fell in love when Zeynep strolled into Chia one afternoon, eager to experience the buzz surrounding the restaurant.
Having parents in the restaurant business and bakery, and at the same time being interested in the industry and seeking to improve himself, Musa became successful. The driving force behind this has mainly been that he was doing something to satisfy his own curiosity. When we first started, there were about 20 different types of kebabs in Turkey. Musa has brought this number up to 100 by producing kebab types with seasonal vegetables and fruit.
Part of the fun of Chia is the detailed story which accompanies each dish. As we sampled various Turkish specialties, from far-flung Syrian border villages to Black Sea hamlets, the intricate story of each individual ingredient enriched the dining experience. Take the kisar salad, a Turkish version of the Middle Eastern staple tabbouleh salad. Chia's version includes produce, which can only be farmed during a select window in early spring. The freeform nature of the food's presentation was equally exciting. Andrew Finkel, again.
I mean, the thing one has to accept about Turkish food often, and this is certainly true of Chia, is that, you know, when you go to a Scandinavian restaurant, you know, the chef puts a plate on the table, and that's, it's a composed plate. You know, they've thought about what the, you know, the fish and what the sauce is and what the vegetable is, and you look at it and it looks attractive, and, you know, everything is there for a preconceived reason. But in Turkey, you really are your own chef. And the whole principle of meze, these little hors d'oeuvres, is that, you know, you have, they're all in the middle, and you make your own plate. You take, you know, you take a little bit of olive oil, and you take something spicy, and you take something salty, and you take something sweet. So you, in a way, it leaves it up to the diner to be the inventive one, which is, you know, a good thing. But it sometimes means that simpler is better.
In some food cultures, people don't like changing food. They enjoy refining it. Istanbul's near total absence of foreign restaurants is a testament to the deep pride which Turks have towards their cuisine. As the country becomes an increasingly important global destination, it's not all about doner kebabs and grilled meats. An unforeseen result of Turkey's near endless ambition for global prominence is that the curious food traveler now has the easy opportunity to explore one of the world's oldest food cultures. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
And we will be continuing the Turkish theme a little later on in the programme as our very own Alexandra de Kramer comes in to tell us what's been making the headlines over in Istanbul this morning. Also, if you want to hear more food and drink stories from around the globe, including a food company in Japan that's embedded itself into the country's popular culture, a report from Genoa's Slow Fish Trade Fair, I shudder to think of what slow fish is, and the last ever Santiago's Basket, we all sob. Tune into the menu. That's tonight at 1900 hours London time here on Monocle 24.
Fear not, though, if you are sobbing at the prospect of that last ever Santiago's Basket, because after this we'll be heading over to Malmö, Sweden, to talk about everyone's dirty little secret, a love affair with Eurovision.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close, and there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well, it has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes bodacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Emma Nelson. The time is 8:43 here in London. And today, alas, it's the final day of our special Eurovision series. Now we have all the 26 finalists ready for the final on Saturday evening. Our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco was following closely the second semi-final yesterday. He had to endure the poor San Marino crowd crying, weeping for their loss. But it's not all bad news. He will tell us what to expect in the final and more.
In fact, we have never seen or heard or witnessed a soul so excited by Eurovision in
or
all our
anything.
Days. Anything. And believe me, as many people will know, Eurovision is something that does stir souls. Fernando, how are you this morning? Are you all right, my love?
I'm very good. I'm not crying like the summer in a crowd. I'm actually very happy to be here.
Are you basically in heaven, Fernando?
I'm in heaven. Emma, it's an incredible atmosphere. I was kind of expecting that, but it's more than what I was expecting, you know, because basically to see, like, thousands of people that are more or less like you, you know, like Eurovision fanatics, it's an incredible view, you know, so I'm really excited.
It is. Now, you watched the second semi-final yesterday, is that correct?
Yes, correct. So now we have all the finalists ready for the big final tomorrow.
Now, if you are a soul who didn't see these semi-finals, of which I can't think of anybody, could you bring us up to speed with the runners and riders, please?
Absolutely. I mean, well, we have a clear favorite this year, which is Denmark, Emily de Forest, which is, she's young, 20 years old, quite a conventional song in terms of Eurovision. For me, it's not very special, but she has, I would say she has 80% of chance to win that. But, you know, we have some quirky contenders. You know that I love the quirky ones, right?
Always.
For example, the Romanian opera disco. The guy dressed up like a vampire and sing opera disco in Romanian. It's just incredible.
I mean, I do know that you very nearly took a picture of yourself, Fernando, with the Queen of Gypsy, the Macedonian entry. Now, why on earth did you bottle out of that one?
Oh God, I feel actually bad. I'm going today to the press center in a few minutes, and I hope she's there because yesterday was a lovely sunny day, and there's an open bar in the press center, and she was there having a drink, and I was like, oh my God, that's a perfect photo opportunity. Her name, by the way, is Esma Redzepova, and she's been going on since 1959, so she's iconic, and she dressed up with this kind of turban, and she has. She's very friendly. I'm not sure if she speaks English, because I met someone from the Israel.
She'll speak the universal language of Eurovision and love, though, Fernando. I can't imagine if you approach her, she won't be desperate for her photograph to be taken.
That turban will get her everywhere.
Just use somebody's language, you know, not a worry, not a problem.
And did you have your shorts on?
Of course. the one with a slit on it, so.
Yes.
Fernando, is there a more serious point to be... I mean, not that that's not serious. Obviously, you in shorts, it's a matter of global international vitality, obviously. But is there a more serious point to be made here? I mean, Eurovision is astoundingly international. It is a point of the international calendar in which people do come together and boundaries are transcended and everyone speaks the universal language of cheesy pop music. Are you feeling that? Is this basically more powerful than, say, I don't know, the United Nations in its own little way?
Well, almost. No, I mean, I'm clearly joking, but am
I? So am I, by the way. But I do want to know about the kind of diplomatic potential of Eurovision.
It is incredibly important, in my opinion, you know, because even countries that, let's say, don't take the event seriously, for example, the UK, I would say, or France. They send, first of all, the share of audience when the Eurovision is on TV is incredibly high, and I was talking with someone from the Germany delegation yesterday as well, that big countries like the Eurovision kind of needs the UK, Germany, those big markets, even if they don't take as seriously as, for example, Sweden and some of the Eastern European countries, they are incredibly vital for the show. And, yeah, it's definitely important. I mean, if you see, for example, the San Marino crowd, they were crying. I mean, and I was talking to someone as well who covers San Marino for Eurovision. They say it's an incredibly important event for the country, for Israel as well. So there is an important point. It's not all about the crazy costumes and cheesy pop songs as well.
That's a very diplomatic answer, Faye. Just tell us a little bit more, though, about how the Swedish are doing Eurovision this year. Do we have grand scale? Do we have cozy? What's their approach?
We have cozy this year. And I was not in Baku in Azerbaijan last year, but I was talking to a lot of people who were there indeed, and they said that it looks more kind of grandiose, and basically they had... For them in the press room, they didn't give computers for the journalists this year, so you had to bring your own. And apparently last year everybody had their own, and it was quite glitzy. But I have to say, I mean, the Swedes are doing an incredible job. You know, they do this cozy vibe, which they call music. And yeah, they're doing incredibly well. Of course, we are in a difficult time in Europe, so they didn't want to kind of to spend so much money on it. But they're doing extremely well. The city is very well organized. I arrived in Malmo Central Station yesterday morning, and my God, it was incredible. There were so many people just dressed up with Eurovision t-shirts and everything. So I think they're doing an incredible good job.
I just have to ask really quickly, of course, we are all pinning our hopes on Bonnie Tyler. Tell us how she's going to do.
Well, I have a feeling she's not going to be on the top five or even top 10, but, well, she's an iconic lady, and hopefully I'll meet her. And I'll let you know, Emma, for sure. Maybe another post opportunity.
I think you could break Jonathan Wheatley's heart by that comment. I really could. I know for a fact that Mr. Wheatley, I do hope this gentleman is listening, has been singing the Bonnie Tyler song at the top of his voice on the editorial floor at Midori House.
She's incredible.
She is that indeed. In Malmo, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much indeed.
He'll be back on Monday to sift through the results and perhaps even tell us a backstage story or two. Well, it's time now, after all of that, for an appropriately sounding song. Here is the Norwegian electro-pop queen Margaret Berger with I Feed You My Love.
A cocoon in a silent tree through the dark night.
I need to sit down after that. Blazing a trail for Norway at this year's Eurovision Song Contest in Malmo. That was Margaret Berger with I Feed You My Love.
This is Midori House, 53 minutes past 8 in the morning in London. Time for a quick check of this morning's Turkish front pages. And joining us in the studio is Monocle researcher Alex de Kramer. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Hi, good morning.
Lovely to see you. You're just back from Istanbul, I know.
Yes, we are.
You had a fantastic time by all accounts. Tell us what's caught your eye in the papers this morning.
Obviously the biggest story that I brought, four newspapers, Cumhuriyet, Zaman, Milliyet and Vatan. And the biggest paper, the headlines on each of them is Erdogan's trip to Washington, D.C. It's regarded as the most important meeting Washington and Ankara had in the past 10 years.
Wow.
And obviously the hot topic was because of the Rayhan, the bombings.
Yeah.
What's going to happen with Syria? And U.S. said they're going to back Turkey in going forward. They obviously agreed that Assad needs to go, but I don't think anything concrete in terms of, and they're going to work on nuclear weapons and looking into whether or not there are nuclear weapons in Syria because the Turkish government claims it does. So we're going to see what will happen in the upcoming days. I just think it's interesting that Turkey didn't retaliate after 50 of its citizens died in the bombings last weekend. And I just think it was a really important step for Prime Minister Erdogan just to visit Washington after that, and that nothing was done.
It is a really difficult position that Erdogan finds himself in, though, isn't it? Because he cannot... They've got this big gap between what the United States' position is and what Turkey's position is. Turkey's pushing for more positive action. It can't push too hard.
True.
Because Turkey also needs to look to the other partners within the Middle East. So how impressed are Turkish people with Erdogan and his approach?
At the moment, I think it was really important when the bombings first happened. He said immediately in the press conference that we're not going to be drawn into, obviously I condemn the attacks, but we're not going to be drawn into civil war in Syria, which is really important because we have such a big border and it would mean so much manpower to be involved. We already have a front, that the PKK, that we are already fighting.
He said, I want to see the glass half full. Yeah. But are people going to respond well? Is this the time for optimism like that?
I think it is, because domestically we have so many issues that we're dealing with. So it would destabilize Turkey if we would go to war with Syria or be involved in it. So he has to see the glass half full.
Let's move on to the news yesterday that Moody's has upgraded Turkey. You know what I mean? Turkey has been upgraded.
Yeah, that's also really important because in terms of foreign investment, we've been waiting for a couple of months for that to happen. So, and it's interesting that Moody said that the PKK leaving, or the government coming to terms with the PKK to some extent, has played a role in this, which I think is a positive outlook to this PKK pulling out of Turkey, because the Turkish people, the public, isn't that happy about what's happening at the moment.
And what does this denote, sort of in a more wider context, for the Turkish economy at the moment?
The investment. Obviously, there's going to be just more foreign investment, because Turkey, yeah, it has been growing. There has been, it is booming. It's the place, it feels like the place to be. Like last week, we felt the same thing, but still we lack foreign investment. So I think that's going to open more doors, because we have for investment in terms of property, not in terms of businesses.
Finally, Alex, the two new legislation packages that you wanted to talk to us about, both of which are quite pointing Turkey in a more strict direction.
Yeah, so that's a story from yesterday and today's Cumhuriyet, that was their headline. They're the more liberal side of journalism. There are two packages introduced, legislation packages introduced. One is to ban alcohol, which has been on the government's agenda for a long time. And the way they want to kind of do it is so public buildings and religious buildings and schools, bars around that, restaurants around that, should not have alcohol licenses. So they're gonna 10 kilometers around these areas. They just want to ban their license, which is again a step forward to diminishing alcohol consumption. Another interesting thing that it's in today's newspaper is about the government wants each school, cinema, park, theater, even
to have a prayer room.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Alex, we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thank you very much indeed for your time. That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer Thomas Lewis and Phil Hahn, our researcher Fernanda Augusto Pacheco, and of course Alex Kramer and Amelia Jen too. Our studio manager gets our thanks as well. That was Alex Funnel. Phil Hahn and Cordelia Lynch will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Emma Nelson,
and me, Clemency Burton Hill, thank you very much for listening.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.